President Trump has spent this week in Asia, or to use the preferred term, the Indo-Pacific. What, if anything, did he accomplish? What, if anything, did he give away? To help us answer such questions, we're joined by Craig Singleton, a former U.S. diplomat. Craig has nearly two decades of experience working in national security in general and U.S.-China relations in particular. He's now senior director for China and a senior fellow as well here at FDD. I'm Cliff May, and I'm glad you're with us too here on Foreign Policy. Hey, Craig, good to see you.
It's great to be here. Turtleneck Thursday.
Turtleneck Thursday, yeah.
Every time we talk dictators, we wear one.
We have to make sure we're properly dressed for these episodes. And this episode, I'm thinking of calling Trump's Orient Express.
I like it.
You like that? Okay, good. So generally speaking, give him high marks for this trip?
Overall, I think he comes off looking pretty good.
Huh.
I mean, amidst some of the turmoil here in D.C. with the shutdown.
Yeah.
He's out there in Asia for a week closing deals, which is what he likes to think of himself as, deal maker in chief.
Right.
So he starts off in Malaysia. He helps mediate.
And he's in Malaysia because there's a meeting there, not because he'll, I mean, because I wondered about that when I first started. I thought, why are you in Malaysia, not Indonesia? Yeah. Indonesia is more pro-American, more moderate Muslim. But there's a regional meeting there.
Yeah, there was an ASEAN
meeting. Association for Southeast Asian Nations. Okay, there you go.
He was there for a few reasons, both that meeting, but also he negotiates this peace deal between Thailand and Cambodia. He lands and finalizes the trade deal with Malaysia, which he's been chasing for a while. He also lands a critical mineral deal with Malaysia, all in one stop. At the same time, he has sidebar conversations with several other countries where he signs deals, including Vietnam and Thailand and Cambodia and Malaysia, all in the same city. It's just like a really beginning, a very serious push to this big trip to the region that, frankly, has been overshadowed a little bit by developments in D.C.
Okay. And just to be clear on something, I give credit, tell me if I'm wrong, to Secretary Besant, because he didn't just walk into these and suddenly make these deals. To do that that fast, my understanding, and you know better, your deputies need to do a lot of footwork in advance. So by the time you get there, you all know what's going to happen and how it's going to unfold, right? I would argue that was the mistake that was made with the Anchorage meeting with Putin, that they didn't know what they were going to come out with.
Sure.
The reason there's no Budapest meeting is because I think Secretary Marco Rubio said to Foreign Minister Lavrov of Russia, I'm not sending my boss to another meeting with your boss unless we know he's going to walk out of there with something in his pocket.
Absolutely. Staff work matters between the Treasury Secretary and Ambassador Greer from the U.S. Trade Representative working in tan, like a tag team here.
Yeah.
Maybe there's a little bit of a good cop, bad cop going on in some of these negotiations. And of course, the president.
Besant is the bad cop?
I think a little bit.
I think
maybe.
So. He looks stern.
He's smart and shrewd.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
No one should discount Greer either.
Really?
A very experienced negotiator and an export control expert. I think between those two deputies out there leading the charge with different countries and the president chiming in routinely with some of his thoughts and feelings about what is an appropriate tariff rate or what's an appropriate deal has ultimately gotten so many deals over the line. And we have to remember that no trade deals in Asia were signed during the Biden administration. The Biden administration had a firm policy against free trade deals. They tried to establish an Indo-Pacific economic architecture that fell apart at the end. And so this is a real sea change for countries in the region, not just because it lowers those countries' tariff on U.S. product, but it really does sort of result in something that's serious and that's tangible and that's something that's quantifiable between the U.S. and all these partners. And so it's a welcome change by a lot of these countries, even if there has been a lot of hand-wringing over the fact that they had to give a lot more than maybe they could take.
And I want to go through these countries, but Xi Jinping is watching all this from Beijing.
Yes.
And what is he thinking as he watches this?
I don't think he can ignore the optics. That's for sure. what occurred between President Trump and the new prime minister of Japan was akin to a love fest. I mean, it was 2 days of watching the Dodgers play in the World Series to going on Marine One to a U.S. military facility to talking about enhanced collaboration on nearly hundreds of billions of dollars of Japanese investment in the United States. I mean, Japan couldn't have gone better. Seoul couldn't have gone better.
Before you leave Japan, and Japan in terms of spending on defense and contributing to collective security.
Exactly, all in.
The new prime minister, she's kind of right wing, and she's kind of, and she gets that she can't be a dependent. She has to be a partner.
She's a security hawk. She's like a Margaret Thatcher-esque figure.
Ooh, that's a high praise indeed.
I think that there's no higher praise than what President Trump said at one of the rallies, which is, we are your strongest, closest ally, and we'll do pretty much anything for you. I mean, that after months of pretty contentious trade negotiations is an amazing signal. And I don't think the Japan leg could have gone any better.
By the way, that reminds me of something you said to me before the mics were on, that this idea that Trump is an isolationist, when you say things like that,
right,
when you're helping Milei in Argentina win his election and get his economy in shape, yep, when you're bombing Iran to keep them from, that's not isolationism in my book.
No, he's an aggressive internationalist, right? I think it's like a muscular realism. And I sort of am curious about whether that's frustrating to some of the more isolationist figures in his administration. Potentially yes, potentially no. But again, I think Trump does Trump. And at this point, he's been everywhere. He's certainly not pulling back to Fortress America. That's for sure.
Right. Okay. All right. So we got Japan. We got and how about South Korea? How is that there? You've got a president, prime minister. I forget which.
Yeah. President
who's pretty left wing and pretty soft on North Korea, from what I'm picking up. Am I wrong?
I think the biggest sort of cleavage point in the relationship right now is trade. That is the one trade deal that the president didn't close, but he did say that the gaps were narrowed. There are some big debates and questions about how far and how big the South Koreans will go in terms of U.S. domestic investment and tariffs. But by and large, the president seemed to have a pretty good personal rapport with the leadership there. And shortly after he departed Seoul, he tweeted on Truth Social that the U.S. would be working in partnership with the South Koreans to build nuclear submarines in Pennsylvania for the South Koreans. This is, I think there are a lot more questions than answers about what that partnership is going to look like. But ultimately, at the end of the day, that was a long-term ask from the South Koreans. And it's hard to imagine that the president would have sort of given in on those issues if he wasn't getting a lot of what he wanted on the trade side. And so overall, again, despite months of turbulence in the U.S.-South Korea relationship, being on the ground, I think more often than not, those leader-to-leader visits result in tangible wins for this president. And he's racked up quite a few in the last week.
I mean, it's important, I would think, for South Korea to keep Trump's goodwill because we have something like 28,000 troops in South Korea, have had them since 1953.
Right.
This is important people remember. The Korean War never ended.
Right.
It's just a truce. Yep. It's a frozen conflict. I mention that because there are other places in the world there may be frozen conflicts and truces rather than peace. I mean, I think it's, you know, Ukraine, Russia, I think it's about all the best you can expect.
Sure.
I don't think Israel and its enemies are going to be singing Kumbaya anytime soon. I think if you were trying to get President Trump to send 28,000 troops now, to South Korea, it would be pretty hard, but keeping them there is easier. Remember how we had the difficulty we had, shouldn't have had, leaving like 10,000 troops in Afghanistan to maintain the achievements we had there. That was, in my view, a terrible mistake to pull out and turn the country over to the Taliban after 20 years. Anyhow, but that they probably will remain, and that's the main, and again, well, this is an important thing. Trump let be known that he'd be interested in meeting Kim Jong-un as long as he was in the neighborhood. Maybe they could get together somewhere, have a chat, cup of coffee,
Starbucks, you know,
a little brandy. I think Kim likes brandy, as my understanding is correct. And Kim, I wasn't interested. Meanwhile, his foreign minister was where? In Moscow, where he's been supplying soldiers, munitions, technical
assistance,
assistance, workers for drone factories, but he's getting something in return. And the things he's getting in return, as far as we understand, maybe technology assistance for submarines and ICBMs.
Right.
And those can, and the only purpose for him having that is to further threaten South Korea, Japan,
right.
Guam, in conjunction with Xi Jinping. Mm-hmm. If there's a war over Taiwan, I would see Xi Jinping saying, I need your help now here. Open a second front for me.
Right.
That's possible.
It's all possible. I thought it was promising that in the past, President Trump has raised a lot of questions about what the U.S. gets out of that security partnership,
guarantees. Right.
But as far as I'm aware, none of those sort of concerns were raised this time around. And what we did see were deals closing on Boeing parts and other aviation equipment and shipbuilding. Remember, the South Koreans have a massive commercial shipbuilding operation. And one of the things that the United States needs to do, and one of the things that we've written about here in our Arsenal of Democracy monograph and other reports, is getting American shipbuilding back up to where it needs to be. And that's going to rely on allied scale, like the South Koreans. They're all in with us. So I think like the counterbalance of trade with defense fits squarely within Trump's worldview. And again, this trip was a triumph for Trump.
Okay. His meeting with Xi Jinping, it lasted for an hour and 40 minutes. That seems not very long for a summit meeting to me. I mean, he has lunches and dinners that are longer than that.
Yeah, I'm not even sure I'd call it a summit.
Okay.
It was like a short get-together. And remember, it's all with linguists and translations.
Oh, yeah, so which eats up time, too.
And pictures. And right when you track it down, it's maybe they were talking for like 30 minutes, like solid 30 minutes. But again, I think a lot of people built up this summit to be something it wasn't. It wasn't going to result in some grand strategic bargain. It was just their first face-to-face meeting that they've had since Trump is back in office. It comes after several months of very serious escalation and de-escalation and tit-for-tat on tariffs and trade and technology in Taiwan. And I think it was an opportunity to clear the air. But ultimately, I think calling it a summit is sort of maybe... we're maybe giving it a little more credit than credit is due.
Okay. Matt Pottinger, brilliant guy. He was in the National Security Council and as Deputy National Security Advisor under H.R. McMaster. He chairs our Asia program. He was really the first one to really prove to people that the great experiment that we had with China, going back to 2001, bringing China into the WTO with the idea that as they get richer, inevitably they would get more moderate, more liberal, more friendly, a better stakeholder in the international rules-based American-led world. Okay, that had failed, all that.
Yes.
So he wrote in the Free Press, one of our favorite publications, yesterday, when we were recording this on Thursday, so that was Wednesday, we were recording this just after
the day of the summit.
Of the summit. He said... just prior to the meeting, that this meeting will determine, I'm quoting now, determine whether America will remain a technological superpower or, if she gets his way, becomes an agrarian commune beholden to Beijing. One more sentence. If Trump gives away advanced NVIDIA chips to Xi, it will mean she needn't have bothered with the new regulations. That's because Trump would be unilaterally deindustrializing America.
Right.
Wow. That's quite a warning.
I mean, trading soybeans for semiconductors is superpower suicide. That's my take. And I think Matt's dead on here. Look, there were a lot of rumors before this summit about what was up for debate. Semiconductors was one of them. Taiwan's fate. Again, this idea that there would be some grand bargain, but that's not what occurred here.
Okay.
On the chip issue, Matt's right in that a few years ago, and he tells this story much better than I can tell, you know, when he was in the presence of Xi Jinping and I believe President Trump in the first term, there was some sort of a discussion about how our president was focused on domestic manufacturing and soybeans and agriculture here, and that the Chinese were really focused on advanced technologies. And the implication was that the Chinese were sort of intimating, well, why don't you take the agricultural stuff and we'll take the technology stuff and we'll all get along and it'll be great. And this wasn't a theory that was immediately sort of countered in the moment. And I think it was a revelation of how the Chinese believe that building supply chain centrality and building out all these core technologies, these cutting edge technologies, the drivers of the next industrial revolution, would result in a world in which we are wholly dependent on the Chinese, and yet we're some sort of an agrarian power, like Matt's articulating. And I think, fortunately, those chip concerns did not manifest during this summit between Xi and Trump. I think it's a topic that is probably not going away.
But it's not settled, you're saying, but it's not going away?
I don't think it's settled.
Okay.
The president has sought to try to sell the Chinese some of our most advanced chips. The belief is that perhaps the Chinese won't be able to develop their own, they won't seek to develop their own indigenous semiconductor supply chain if they're getting the best stuff from us.
Mm-hmm.
China watchers like myself argue that this is sort of nonsensical. They're going to continue to speed up semiconductor manufacturing and their sophistication with the ultimate goal of not buying any of our chips, developing their own indigenous industry, then scaling that globally. So for right now, they're very content to get their hands on some of these chips because our chips are way more advanced. But ultimately, this is not an addiction scenario. They want to avoid the idea that they're reliant on us for this critical technology. They want to scale it domestically. The president believes that maybe we can buy some goodwill by giving them some of these advanced chips. The challenge is that a few months ago when we did offer them some pretty advanced chips called the H20s from a company called NVIDIA,
yeah,
the Chinese said, yeah, no thanks. And the reason is because, well, it's really twofold. One was it was presented from certain White House advisors that we could get China addicted to these chips. And the Chinese heard this and reflexively said, no, we're not here for that. No way. And then there were all these media reports that these chips had back doors, that they could be manipulated and accessed by the U.S. government after. And that led to the Chinese government issuing bulletins saying, you can't buy these chips. We understand that Chinese businesses would benefit from them because they're advanced, but this is a security risk and it's also a pride issue. So you have the issue of paranoia about the chips, and then the pride component that we can't become addicted to what they're selling. And this has primarily been the biggest hurdle to resolving the chip issue. It's not going away. But I do suspect that, again, like the hindrance here isn't the United States. Our president seems willing to try to sell these chips to the Chinese. It's China being its own worst enemy and saying, we don't want to take them.
The head of NVIDIA, what's his name?
Jensen Huang.
Huang. He was in somewhere in Japan or somewhere in Asia this time, and he wants very much to sell his best chips to China, and is making the case. This will be good for us.
Yeah,
I'm very dubious about this. We'll get addicted, and I've told this story many times that years ago, very senior German diplomat. And saying, why are you getting addicted to Russian gas and oil?
Right.
And he said, no, it's the Russians getting addicted to the euro, where right. that they want our money more than we need. And I said, I don't think so. And I was right and he was wrong, as usual.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yes, dear leader. I mean, my suspicion for this one is that it's so confusing because NVIDIA has a $5 trillion valuation.
No.
With having no sales in China. So it's obviously not a company that's hurting. But more importantly, there was an interview that came out recently with Jensen in which he says, I don't really care if it's US or China wins the AI competition. I'm agnostic.
Ugh.
And I thought that was just sort of really an interesting revelation because the White House's own AI action plan says specifically the US needs to win the AI competition. And so I suspect that as Jensen speaks more and more about his views on AI competition and some of these other competing demands here in the United States play out for advanced chips, that this sort of position that the company is putting itself in may be untenable.
Yeah.
They have a very bright future and a lot of interest from lots of well-capitalized U.S. companies to do partnerships. I just suspect that China may or may not be part of that equation.
Yeah, I mean, I do think the National Energy Defense Council National Energy Dominance Council, which we profiled with Rich Goldberg here, I think it was last week, very clear that we have to dominate in AI, whoever. And, you know, Putin has said, this is a quote I've used before, but it's interesting because Putin's a tyrant, but not stupid. He hasn't stayed in power this long because he's stupid, that whoever dominates in AI will dominate the world.
Absolutely.
Now, I don't think he expects to do it. I don't think they're that good. But China, this is a really important competition.
Absolutely.
Energy dominance, mm-hmm. AI, which is related to AI dominance,
right.
Because at least for now, the technology could change, so much electricity is needed
yes.
for data AI data centers. Right.
No, it's yeah. these drivers of this, I think it's an industrial revolution. We're on the cusp of it, whether it's AI and it's biotech and what happens in semiconductors. Whoever controls that, mm-hmm. those key drivers, is going to be the most powerful country in the world. And that needs to be the United States. And we shouldn't have any doubt about the fact that there's a number one and there's a number two here. Right now, in some of these categories, we're number one, and others we're number two. I think it's great that this administration is starting to really go after the regulation on the energy side, deregulating how we can build up nuclear, how we can think through critical rare earths. What are we doing domestically on energy? Because we do need to build out this infrastructure and the AI data centers across this country to effectively scale this technology. And we know what our pain points are and we know what China's are. What's so fascinating is like our whole model here in the United States is built on like selective exclusion. We are thinking about cutting off China, for example, from some of these technological inputs, right? Through export controls and things like that. But the Chinese think about it a little differently. They think about selective exclusivity. They think about controlling the rare earth inputs that they control, right?
Well, and that's what, just stay on that for a second. On October, I think October 9th, they suddenly had this very restrictive export regime on there on rare earths, which
a global regime.
A global regime. I mean, and I thought that in a way, tell me if I'm wrong, that was a mistake on their part because it was a wake-up call for all those who thought we don't need to compete in this area,
sure.
but we do need to compete in this area, both domestically mining, having for some of the rare earths, we need to go to other places.
Sure.
Trump has started this with Malaysia, with Australia.
Yeah. There's a G7 meeting this week specifically to counter China's rare earth grab.
Yeah.
All the G7 countries coming together and saying this wasn't just an attack on the United States. This new rule more or less gave China de facto control over any product around the world that even used small amounts of Chinese rare earths and magnets.
Yeah, tiny, like minute amounts.
I mean, it was really, I still think it was a miscalculation in that all of the other countries around the world are sitting there and being like, oh, wait, I'm victimized here as well. Where can we partner with other countries? This allied scale sort of concept comes into play where US, Japan, Korea, Australia being a massive sort of mining superpower itself. We're all meeting, we're all discussing Canada, even like this is one area where I think the US and Canada actually see eye to eye amidst a deteriorating relationship. What are we going to do here to reduce China's stranglehold? Right. And the reality, in my view, is that we can speed up a lot faster on resolving the rare earth issue than China can speed up on semiconductors.
Okay, and speeding up on rare earths means getting mining going quicker. You can't
mining,
take 18 years to get a mine going. It's possible, but you have to get rid of it. That's mostly red tape. How about processing? The Chinese are best at processing.
Sure.
Use a lot of energy, mostly from coal, to do it.
Environmentally, very dangerous.
Very dangerous. Can we get to how long does it take for us to gear up so we're doing processing here, or at least our close allies are doing it?
Elsewhere. I mean, this is the big question. I mean, getting them out of the ground isn't as complicated. It's a red tape issue. You're right.
It's a
regulatory
issue.
Problem.
Yeah.
And there's certainly enough capital floating around now to fund rare earth startups. Processing is the Achilles heel. The Chinese have a stranglehold over it. That's by design. I suspect, though, that there'll be certain countries that want to get involved in supporting these well-capitalized Western-driven efforts and to present themselves as a foil to the Chinese in terms of processing. And it'll be very interesting in the coming years which sort of countries raise their hand to do that. I've always thought, maybe it's optimistic, especially amidst everything that's going on in the Western Hemisphere, that Canada, Mexico, and the United States through USMCA could do this beautifully.
Mm.
Whether you're mining either in Canada, where they have extensive mining and shale.
USMCA being the trade agreement of the three,
exactly.
Mexico, America, Canada. Yeah.
And it's coming up for renegotiation.
Okay.
What if you really build out a rare earth pillar,
right.
like a line of effort?
Yeah.
Could you do some of the processing in parts of Mexico? Potentially. You could run the product along rail lines that run between the three countries, right?
Mm.
And then you would have, in theory, like a trusted domestic supply of both the materials, unrefined and processed, I think this is an area where we have a lot of options with our partners to the north and our partners in Mexico. And it'll be interesting to see if this starts to become a key point of the conversation.
Also, from my understanding, you'll know better, there are quite a few rare earths in Alaska. Mm-hmm. And so they, you plug that in, you know, plug that in through Canada, and yep. now you get the, you bring them in as well.
Between that and the LNG in Alaska, I mean, like, yeah, I think we're starting to recognize that we have access to these tremendous commodities that are going to, again, serve as like the underpinning for some of the build out of these new core technologies and just our broader energy needs. Wouldn't we rather be reliant on ourselves than reliant on the Chinese, especially now that we know that they're willing to weaponize and turn on and off those supply chains at will as a weapon against us? And there shouldn't be any doubt anymore, even before the recent October rule, that the Chinese are willing to go that far.
Right. And in terms of the high-end chips, the NVIDIA chips, evidently Congress is concerned about this, right? Sure. I just saw not long before this, we got together, the Guaranteeing Access and Innovation for National Artificial Intelligence, the GAIN AI Act.
Right.
To ensure that American companies remain at the front of the line for the advanced AI chips. And it's bipartisan as part of the from the select committee.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's the idea behind part of GAIN AI is that there are a finite number of chips. U.S. companies are saying, I am desperately in need of more high-end chips. And so with,
there's only so many factories
and there's only so much supply and
we're
going through these things so fast. And so one of the things GAIN AI does is it says that U.S. customers would be prioritized over the Chinese or over even external customers, in theory, driving the semiconductors into our economy and reducing the ability of some semiconductor providers to sell them to other countries, but particularly the Chinese. It's not without its own controversy, just because, again, as I mentioned, President Trump seems to be in favor of trying to sell lots of different chips to China. But the fact that this is a strong bipartisan consensus in Washington is a powerful counterweight. And I suspect that there'll be a lot of discussion about this bill in particular, but I'm hopeful it will pass, simply because I think it sort of sets a standard that we should be feeding our domestic innovation before we start to think about feeding.
Well, it's America first position for sure.
Sure. I mean,
so you don't think this is not a bill that Trump's likely to veto? He may probably knows about it and doesn't think it's a bad idea.
I haven't seen anything publicly that he's got a strong opinion on it.
Okay.
And I think if there's one thing we know about the president, he seems to have a strong opinion about everything.
Oh, yeah.
So it might be a little bit of a wait and see.
Yeah.
But ultimately, again, because the bill is aimed at domestic innovation and building up our economy, I'd like to think that he sees the value of prioritizing U.S. customers over foreign customers. We'll wait to see what comes of it. That won't, again, resolve the issue on chip sales to China writ large. But I think it is an important marker for Congress that is saying that, with them saying, we're going to prioritize domestic renewal and our own dynamism.
Okay. All right. So a few other subjects. Fentanyl.
Yes.
Precursors go from China to Mexico to cartels in Latin America. They make the fentanyl from the precursors, send them into the U.S., kills loads of Americans. As long ago as 7 years in Argentina, you had Xi Jinping saying, you know what? I see it's a problem. Let me see what I can do about it. I am skeptical that this is the kind of thing, well, he's trying to get his arms around this problem, but you know, it's not so easy. No, if this were, you know, if these were a couple of, I don't know, Christians praying in a basement, he would put an end to it right away.
Uyghur activists, anything like
that. Uyghur activists,
sure.
Or Falun Gong. So now if I understand, Trump thinks he's promised again to do something about the fentanyl precursors, but I don't trust them.
You know, as part of the deal that was the framework, I should say, that was agreed to in Korea, the United States has lowered its headline fentanyl tariff rate by 10 percentage points. So now the tariff rate with China is about 57, now it's about 47%.
Mm.
Okay. And that was contingent, he believes, on the fact that China will work hard with him on the fentanyl issue. Now, I think we are all right to be skeptical about whether the Chinese will actually take meaningful steps But there's a little bit of a beauty in Trump's design. Of course, he could snap those tariffs right back in a few months if we don't see meaningful collaboration. And we should note that there's a public reporting that the FBI director, Kash Patel, will be traveling soon to Beijing to meet with Chinese officials to talk about these very issues. I think how those meetings go and whether we see verifiable and consistent fentanyl collaboration will determine whether the president says, okay, we still have 47% tariffs, exceptionally high. I could snap these back on if we see sort of malign behavior from the Chinese. But maybe this was necessary to get the Chinese to the table to even agree to work with them. You know, this drop, this 10% drop, maybe it was a sort of just a requirement to set the table. And that's possible, but it can't go on indefinitely forever.
Do you buy the theory that the fentanyl being sent to America by China is, in Xi Jinping's view, condign punishment, justice for the opium wars of the 19th century, the Europeans addicted Chinese to opium? And he looks, you know, it wasn't the Americans, but, you know, Brits, Americans, they all look alike. Yeah. And that this is kind of his revenge for that.
I don't know if it's that, if it's that visceral.
Okay.
I'm just not sure that Xi Jinping cares. It's not his problem, right? The people of China are addicted to fentanyl. These products go into a lot of, the fentanyl precursor products go into a variety of U.S. industries as well.
They do. They have good uses as well.
Very good uses, particularly in the pharma space. But
in the pharma space, exactly.
Yeah. And I do think that in general, we do need these things, and we need to obviously address our fentanyl epidemic here. But by and large, I think Xi Jinping believes that the U.S. is a declining or collapsing power anyway, and that what we're seeing in the drug war is just a symptom of that broader disease. And again, I'm not sure that without a lot of pressure that they will take steps to resolve this issue. We're going to find out. This is a nice test between now and the president's likely trip to Beijing in April 2026, which is what they announced today. That's a few good months to see whether we have actual collaboration on fentanyl or whether perhaps that trip shouldn't go on and we should slap back more tariff on the Chinese.
Okay. Also, not discussed as far as I know, was TikTok, right?
That's right.
He made no mention of it. Despite the fact there were some earlier signs from the White House that he and she might finalize some agreement on the app. Do you have any sense of where that's going? And particularly, I mean, the important thing is not just that it be sold, but that the algorithm not be in the hands of the Chinese Communist Party. It's too, you know, that's, again, we've said this before, that's like selling, you know, New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, CBS, NBC, and ABC in the middle of the Cold War to the Kremlin.
Sure. I mean, I think the Chinese have made clear that whatever occurs with this divestiture deal over TikTok, it will be in compliance with Chinese law. So ultimately, it's the Chinese that will get the ultimate say here, not President Trump. And they've been very selective in not giving the president the final approval for this deal. And in fact, today, after the meeting in Korea, China's Ministry of Foreign, or I think it was their Ministry of Commerce, put out just something again saying, like, the TikTok deal will be finalized when it's sort of consistent with Chinese law, and that's when we'll have a final deal.
Well, that sounds like no, we keep the algorithm. Sorry, Charlie, right? Well, I think President Trump shouldn't accept that, and then we should that leads to a ban.
What's concerning, I think, is that the executive order that the White House issued would do just that. It would allow the Chinese to maintain algorithmic control. It's not, we would in fact be licensing the algorithm from the Chinese. And this is in direct conflict with the statute that was passed by Congress in both houses on a bipartisan basis and upheld by the Supreme Court 9-0. The executive order also sort of implies that ByteDance, which is TikTok's parent company, would retain a board seat on this new venture. Well, the last time I checked, board seats usually involve operational relationships, control over certain parts of the company. And the law is clear. No operational relationship may exist between the foreign adversary and whatever this new venture is. So I think the executive order stretches the law in ways that are deeply problematic. And as far as we know, Congress actually hasn't been briefed on the final details here. And before we have a final deal, it sounds like something Congress should dig into. What was actually agreed to? Who controls the algorithm? Will employees from ByteDance still be servicing the algorithm? What does this all look like? And right now, there are more questions than answers.
She's got algorithm. Who could ask for anything more?
Right. Yeah.
Some people will get my joke there. Anyway, also not discussed, Taiwan, right?
I mean, I think that's great news. There were so many rumors in the lead up to this summit that Taiwan's fate would be negotiated away as part of some grand bargain with the Chinese. And the reality is that no one at the table on the U.S. side or the Chinese side during these negotiations is really involved in Taiwan affairs or security-related matters. The meeting was really just focused on trade. And I think that that sends a powerful message that perhaps Taiwan is not up for sale. It's not going to become a pawn in some sort of broader trade deal. And whether Taiwan becomes a point of contention in the future or not, there is no doubt. But it is interesting that, at least from the U.S. readout, Taiwan was not raised by the Chinese side during this encounter.
Well, 2 points here. One is that Xi has said to his military, you should be prepared by 2027.
To have the capability to retake Taiwan.
To take Taiwan or retake Taiwan.
Taiwan is better.
Yeah, okay. And Trump presumably will still be president there, so it should be a concern to him.
Yeah.
I've heard it said, I'm not sure I totally buy this, but maybe it has some credibility, that when you have all the, that you have all these trade deals and that they're mm-hmm. important to China, if she's thinking about, okay, it's 2027, let's get this done, you might think, you know, things are going fairly well right now for me, and this is going to screw up all the trade deals we have, and we still need America as a market, and that this would be a reason for him not to decide on
like
any given morning.
Huh? Like a deterrent.
Like a deterrent, because there's a real, he's thinking, what are the downsides of trying to take the island, at least through force? Again, mm-hmm. as you more than know, you and I,
yes,
were in Taiwan.
Slow motion strangulation is the best.
Yeah,
right?
You did a tabletop exercise, a war game, in which said that there are better ways than kinetic to take sure. Taiwan. And he may think, let's move in that direction, because I don't want to ruin the factory that makes the highest top chips in the world. Mm-hmm. I want to have that be part of my empire, et cetera, et cetera.
My dominion, yeah. I think the reality is that I'm not sure how much Xi Jinping will price in economic damage to his economy to seek the rejuvenation of the Chinese nation, right? There's no doubt that he believes it's his historical destiny to retake Taiwan, even though I'm still not convinced that an invasion is imminent. I think one of the things that's been so apparent on all of our trips to Taiwan is, right, there's already underway a very serious slow motion strangulation campaign against the country, whether it's the high intensity military operations that are going around it, a lot of what's occurring in the trade space, the Chinese are exerting economic and diplomatic pressure on Taiwan, a lot of political meddling and disinformation on the island itself, really to erode confidence in the current government in Taiwan. This slow motion strangulation exists every day, and it's a reality, and it's only going to get worse, and it could pay off in the long run. My bigger fear is that because of the intensity of these military operations that have been normalized around Taiwan, that we could see some sort of like a sharp, sudden break. Maybe there's a mid-air collision between Chinese and Taiwanese aircraft or vessels in the water, just because now you have so many more vessels not really communicating with one another. And we're seeing what's occurring in the South China Sea, where the Chinese are in effect ramming Philippine vessels, quite aggressive, right? Could that same lack of professionalism apply around Taiwan? And then what would happen is there's this moment where neither side intended for there to be a massive escalation, but because of a sudden shock like this, we're working our way up the escalation ladder. And it's just not clear that cooler heads could prevail here. And so there's the full-blown, the Chinese decide they're going to invade and have a kinetic land invasion, which, again, I just don't think is feasible today and probably the worst case scenario. You have this slower strangulation strategy that is working quite well, where there's a lot of opportunity for us to be assisting Taiwan to build up its resiliency. I just got to testify before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee on that. But then you have this this very serious risk of a sudden shock. And it's just not entirely clear in that moment how that would play out. And I think that's the major risk, is could we get sucked into a conflict? Could that lead to a really serious World War III scenario? And it's just getting more and more concerning.
You know, and I just want, you know Chinese history way better than I do, but you'll help me on this. This idea that China wants, that Beijing, that Xi Jinping wants to reunify China.
That's their rhetoric.
I understand, but I want people to understand why I'm pressing on this point. The fact of the matter is, as I understand, Taiwan was a colony of Japan longer than it was a colony ever of China. And when it was a colony of China, it was a colony way back when in the Qing Dynasty.
Sure.
The Qing Dynasty was the Manchus up in Manchuria. Okay? That's an ethnic minority who conquered the Hans, the major ethnic group of China, right, down below. If you look at a map and you look at Manchuria, mm-hmm, and you look at East Turkestan, better known as Xinjiang, where the, yeah, Uyghurs are, and you look at Tibet, what you see is these are possessions of a Chinese empire. Right. They are not part of China. And Taiwan was really not part of China, again, except during this Manchu dynasty, going back to, what was it, the 17th century to the 19th century, something like that?
Even then, quite questionable.
Okay. And yes, after the Civil War, the KMT, the Kuomintang, when they lost the Civil War, the nationalists to the communists, they escaped to Taiwan. But, you know, and actually, the KMT, the Kuomintang, they're softer on communist China now than other political parties. Anyhow, it's not what we're talking about. It is no more correct to say that this is a rogue province that Xi Jinping wants to reunite with China under the Communist Party, which nobody wants to be, than it would be to say, you know, Cuba is an island just 90 miles off of Key, off Florida, so we should take it back and reunite it with America. No difference at all that I can see.
I mean, I think there's a rhetorical myth that the Chinese government, or the Chinese Communist Party, we should say, has created about Taiwan and its fate. But we shouldn't have any doubt that the Chinese Communist Party truly believes that taking Taiwan is like the linchpin and is a key factor in the China dream, in rejuvenating the historical ancestry of the country, and as sort of a makeup for the century of humiliation that occurred with the breakdown of the dynasty and the empire. And I think that the one thing that's sort of standing in the way now that the Chinese have taken back Hong Kong is, in their mind, Taiwan. And it's a problem that can no longer be left to linger. And I fear that Chinese overconfidence could lead to a miscalculation and could lead them to take steps that would result in any of the scenarios that we've described, because taking the island is so central to Xi's ethos and his historical destiny in his mind that you can't separate the man from the myth anymore.
But I would just say that it is an imperialist dream that we're talking about here. This is the Communist Party of which rules China is an imperialist party.
I think
they also have eyes on Central Asia and other places. And by the way, years from now, they may look north to what Russia calls parts of its empire.
I mean, yeah, and say, the Sino-Soviet split. I mean, that's the roots of the whole split.
Yeah.
I mean,
not a lot of Russians and a lot of resources, and they got a lot of Chinese and not a lot of resources. I think it's 20 years away or so, but yeah.
Potentially. I mean, and you have a weakened Russia from the Ukraine war, right? A lot of less able-bodied men to fight. Who knows? I mean, I think one thing we have to realize quite clearly is that China doesn't seem content with operating only within its borders. It has grand designs.
Yeah.
And where those grand designs begin or end is unclear to me. I think it's unclear to the Chinese too, but they're certainly not content with the status quo.
Right. All right. Anything else we should talk about that I didn't think to ask about in terms of this deal in terms of as I'd say Trump's Orient Express.
Yeah, I would just say on the deal, really mixed bag.
Okay.
Right. So we said that we saw this drop in headline tariff by about 10% in exchange for the promise of fentanyl collaboration, that's pretty wait and see. We'll see where it goes. The Chinese have agreed to temporarily pause the rare earth licensing scheme that we discussed. And the U.S. is temporarily pausing for 1 year a massive rule that it laid out in October that would, in effect, target the subsidiaries of companies that are on what we call our entity list, companies that would be denied technology. And this was a pretty serious rule that the Commerce Department put forward early in the year, and we're going to pause that as well. So there's a pause for a pause. The Chinese did commit to buying billions of dollars of U.S. soybeans, which is a serious win, I think, for the president, especially with farm constituents across the United States. And both countries decided to rescind these threats of port fees that they were going to employ against each other's ships. So again, like more pause for pause. I think the fact that chips and TikTok and Taiwan and certainly no other serious rollbacks of export controls or delistings of Chinese companies is more or less good news for as long as this current truce holds, which I would just caution is probably not very long. Think of it like a tactical pause. And I suspect we're just sort of in this cycle. There's rivalry with no resolution. There is just, it seems like every truce is just the start of the next round of tit for tat escalation and conflict. And I wouldn't be surprised if this current deal breaks down for any number of reasons, but primarily because the other side believes that they've been duped.
Right. Well, we're in a cold war with China, and it's a war about the future of the planet. And China's been very clear, as Matt Pottinger has pointed out, that they believe that there's a common destiny for mankind, and that Beijing and the Communist Party of China will
be
at the top.
Right. Absolutely.
And if we don't want that, then we have to decide. If we understand, again, you can have detente and you can have pauses and you can have, but we have to realize we're in this Cold War, and China has very close allies in Moscow, Tehran, and Pyongyang.
Are we competing to coexist or competing to win?
Right.
And I think this is where we find ourselves at an inflection point today. And again, some people say that President Trump is the most dovish China hawk in the room. I think this deal suggests that he is really focused on headline wins rather than sort of really going head to head with the Chinese. We'll see, though, what happens. Remember, Trump in his first term also had the belief that deals could be struck with lots of countries, including China. A lot of those deals broke down, and that's when he resorted to tariffs the first time and pressure on Chinese technology companies like Huawei. Everything this administration, this round, seems way more compressed, right? It took about 2.5 years for the first Trump administration for him to really start to weaponize tools. It took 2.5 weeks this time. We're not even a year in. If this current truce breaks down, which I suspect it will, we're going to find ourselves back in this mutually assured disruption, which is where we are today. And I think we all just sort of have to buckle up and prepare for that.
All right. That sounds like Trump earned his pay this week anyway. He should take a play around of golf at Mar-a-Lago over the weekend.
The man doesn't stop. I don't know where he gets the energy, but the man does not stop.
He does stop to play golf, doesn't he?
I mean, even that's work.
Yes,
I'm tired after playing golf. I don't know about you, but like the guy just nonstop. I don't know how anyone on his staff can keep up with him, but he's like the Energizer Bunny. But again, what he isn't is an isolationist, and this guy is everywhere. Let's hope he can direct that energy towards good purposes, good ends.
Craig, lots of great points you've made today. Thanks for explaining to me and to our audience what this trip was all about and what happened on it. Thanks again.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me.
And thanks to all of you who have been with us for this conversation here today on Foreign Policy.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Foreign Policy. If you enjoyed the show, please rate us, preferably with 5 stars. Ratings and reviews help give us visibility and the opportunity to reach more people who seek to understand the most critical national security and foreign policy issues. Also, make sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. Follow FDD on social media and visit our website at fdd.org. There you can find research by FDD experts, you can subscribe to all FDD's products, you can catch up on any past episodes you may have missed.
Finally, we'd love your feedback, your ideas, your questions, your criticisms. Send us an email at foreignpodacy@fdd.org. Until next time, I'm Cliff May, and you've been listening to Foreign Podacy.